mergers and acquisitions.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Good morning. It's the Morning Open, a look at the markets and the economy as we start trading for the day and week. Where's Wall Street? Markets are up right now. The S&P up by 1%. The NASDAQ and Dow up about more than 1%, as a matter of fact, this hour. European shares are higher right now. German DAX is up nearly 2%. Investors happy about a pro-business parliament there. In Asia, the trading week started on a down note, however. Markets shed 2 to 2.5% overseas today. We got a couple of big announcements today in the mergers and acquisitions department. Pharmaceutical maker Abbott Labs is paying more than $6.5 billion for the drugs unit of Belgium's Solvay. Analyst Richard DeKayser is president of Woodley Park Research. He joins us live from Washington this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So that, and of course we heard about Xerox and this outsourcing company out of Texas. I mean, what strikes me about these deals, we're talking $6-plus billion, they're cash deals. Where are these companies getting all this cash?
Well, it varies from case to case, but they're sitting on it. They have been for some time, and what really has been holding things back has been a lack of confidence. And that's why I think this is so inspirational to the markets. We've had this ambiguous moment where business confidence has been low but recovering, and these purchase agreements, especially the Xerox purchase at a huge premium over Friday's close, suggest that CEOs are not sitting on their hands anymore, starting to make acquisitions, and there can be no greater vote of confidence.
And what does this tell us about the broader economy, Richard?
Well, we know the broader economy is doing much better in the third quarter, and earnings will be much better in the third quarter. The outlook is where things get a little bit murkier, and there's a divided opinion. But even the worst outlook is for still a recovery in profits relative to where we were over the course of the past year. So an improving environment in terms of picking up an improving economy in the context of all the cost-cutting we've seen over the past 2 years is giving way to a profit rebound, and again, increasingly, that's starting to look brighter.
And perhaps more jobs down the road as well.
We'll see that on Friday. We're going to get the jobs report for September. No one's expecting a big increase, or an increase at all for that matter, but a smaller decline would be very encouraging.
All right. Richard DeKayser, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
All right. Quick question as we look at the broader economy this morning. Should the Federal Reserve or should the Treasury take the lead in regulating the financial system? World Bank President Robert Zoellick offers his take this morning. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The leader of the World Bank is giving no slack to central bankers around the globe. He says they've not addressed the risks when it comes to regulating the economy. So Robert Zoellick says, give more control in financial reform to the U.S. Treasury. His comments are part of a speech he's expected to give today at Johns Hopkins University. The Obama administration has been pushing to put the Fed in charge of overhauling the financial system. But Zoellick says central bankers haven't quite done the job in keeping us out of economic calamity. Plus, the Fed is only a quasi-governmental organization. On the other hand, Congress has more control over the Treasury. So it may be better able to oversee the Treasury as it regulates those large financial institutions. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And we heard from Hugh Johnson, chief economist from Johnson Ellington Advisors, who says he's not so sure about the Treasury.
I would choose the Fed. And it was primarily because of the unique qualifications of the people that work at the Fed. In my judgment, they're better qualified to do the job.
Economist Hugh Johnson. Listening to the Morning Report for Monday, September 28th, 2009, at marketplace.org. Germany's parliament is about to shift to the right in an affirmation of her party's pro-business policies. Voters there gave Chancellor Angela Merkel another term and at the same time ousted the left-leaning Social Democrats from an awkward coalition she had maintained. Marketplace European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is with us to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So if the Social Democrats are out, who's now in coalition with Merkel?
A party which is much more in tune with her political philosophy, pro-business, market-oriented, in favour of tax cuts and slimming down government bureaucracy. It is the FDP, the Free Democrats. Germany will now have, with Merkel in alliance with the FDP, a pro-business government committed to economic reform. And indeed, business groups are celebrating in Germany today.
And how's it expected to affect German policy, Stephen?
Well, in the short term, perhaps not by very much. I mean, Merkel has shown over the past 4 years that she's a very cautious and careful leader, and she is constrained. She's got a very big budget deficit with all the stimulus packages, so there's not huge scope for big tax cuts. And also, the German recovery is pretty fragile. The big question, as in other countries, is how will the economy perform as the various stimulus packages wind down? Cash for clunkers, for example. It's been extremely successful. Sales of new cars were up 28% in August. But the programme is now over, and there's one forecast that sales will slump by 1 million cars next year. So not too much scope for radical economic reform.
And how does it quickly, Stephen, affect relations with the United States?
They will improve. Merkel's new partner, the FDP, is very pro-American.
All right. Stephen Beer joining us from the Marketplace European desk in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Steve.
Researchers this week are meeting in New York to see what may come of a possible new AIDS vaccine. They describe recent trial results in Thailand as a breakthrough. More now from reporter Joel Rose.
While the trial results are encouraging, researchers caution that any public health benefit is still years and billions of dollars away.
But there's now a proof of concept. We now know that an AIDS vaccine is possible, and it certainly makes the case for additional investments, I think, much stronger.
Marshall Warren directs the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition. He'll join dozens of scientists, vaccine makers, government officials, and philanthropic donors at a meeting this week in New York. Warren is hoping to see more investment from pharmaceutical companies. So far, he says they account for little of the $850 million a year flowing into AIDS vaccine research.
There's been very limited private sector engagement. Industry has been involved in AIDS vaccine research, but not with its own money, in large part because industry finds this science very risky, and it is very risky science.
Warren says pharmaceutical companies reduced their funding after a promising AIDS vaccine from drug maker Merck failed 2 years ago. He hopes the Thai results will have the opposite effect. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Probably heard about some Americans who travel abroad and demonstrate bad behavior. But as more and more Indians travel outside their borders, they're starting to get a bad rap, too. Raymond Thibodeau reports from New Delhi.
A recent survey from the online travel agency Expedia had some bad news for Indian travelers. 4,500 surveyed hoteliers from around the world rated Indians as some of their worst customers, loud, fussy, and cheap. Ritu Sehgal, who manages a travel agency here in New Delhi, is unabashed.
We kind of enjoy life full size, you know, king size or something. I'm not apologetic about the Indian customer being thrifty. Even I like a good bargain if I get it.
In India, it's normal for middle and upper class people to have a cook, a driver, a nanny. She says that master-servant relationship is often carried abroad, so travelers treat waiters, flight attendants, and taxi drivers as underlings.
That's not that they're trying to be rude or mean or anything. They just don't know a different way to be. So there again, our role comes in, I think. We need to educate them.
She says the West also needs to familiarize itself with the habits of Indian travelers. She says Indians often complain to her that hotels rarely offer Bollywood movies, and that foreign restaurant workers often don't know that many Indians prefer to eat with their hands. Azhar Usman is an Indian comedian based in Chicago. He says stereotyping of any kind isn't helpful, but then again,
just as not all American tourists, you know, fit the stereotype of the ugly American, we all know that there are some people that do.
He says the bigger issue here is the rise of a class of Indians who can afford to travel abroad.
Folks are not necessarily getting acculturated into, you know, perhaps the best way to behave yourself. The very fact that we have a category now of the Indian traveler, it speaks volumes about how far India has come as a country.
With the global slowdown, India is one of the few countries still spending on travel. Again, Ritu Sehgal from the travel agency.
Can any one of us who are in this business can survive without the rich Indian traveler, ugly or beautiful, whatever?
And many tour companies from the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East seem to agree. They've set up offices in cities like New Delhi and Mumbai. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Big utilities said last week they would leave the U.S. Chamber of Commerce trade group. They say they don't like the chamber's opposition to a climate bill that's working its way through Congress. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, environmentalists and others are questioning whether the chamber's president can be an honest broker in this debate.
For more than a decade, the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue, has also served on Union Pacific's board of directors. The railroad has rewarded Donahue with stock options worth more than $1 million. And as part of his service, Donahue's agreed to abide by Union Pacific's policy on conflicts of interest. Basically, directors there
may not engage in any activities or conduct that are contrary to the best interests of Union Pacific.
Pete Altman is at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Then you have to wonder, is Mr. Donahue complying with that directive from Union Pacific and only allowing decisions that are in that company's best interests?
This matters to Altman because Union Pacific has a big stake in the climate debate. Roughly 20% of its revenue comes from hauling coal, and the company is lobbying to oppose the climate bill. But many other members of the Chamber of Commerce have taken very different positions. And Beth Young, with the independent research firm The Corporate Library, says that's problematic for Donahue.
There would always be sort of a nagging suspicion that his interests as a director of that outside corporation were influencing him in his role at the chamber.
I can tell you it's never been an issue for our membership.
David Chavern is the chief operating officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Our membership does not see the conflict of interest, and it's their interests that are at stake here.
But debate over the chamber's climate policy has been intense. Johnson & Johnson and Nike have both publicly criticized the chamber's stance. Then last week, two big utilities, including PG&E, actually quit the chamber because of what they said was the group's, quote, extreme rhetoric and obstructionist tactics. Beth Young says Tom Donahue clearly has a problem.
If I were in his position, I would probably see resigning from the Union Pacific board as the cleanest way of dealing with the problem.
And if Donahue doesn't resign, Young believes the chamber should force him to. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Finally, the creamier version of Vegemite in Australia has a new name, and like its predecessor, there was a contest about what to call the spread. A 20-something web designer came up with iSnack 2.0. Kraft Foods says it chose the name because it's the next generation of Vegemite. But online comments haven't been so tasty. On a food forum, posts range from, I thought this thread was about a new iPhone app, or it's a pretty spazzy name, LOL. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.